Focus with Jessica Strutt on ABC Radio Perth.
First came the smartphones, then the smart televisions, and soon enough the white goods were in on the act. Your fridge could let you know when you need to pick up milk and eggs. Now, we live in the age of the smart city. We have one right here in East Perth. The promise is, and I quote, "The data will provide valuable insights and assist decision-making for planners, businesses and residents, as well as enhance the efficiencies of existing safety and security measures," end quote. What does all of that mean? What can a smart city know about us just as we move through it? Where does it store that data it collects about us? And is that data for sale? Science fiction has been dreaming up smart computers for decades. We think it's going to be like this.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What's the problem?
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
But the reality is often more like this.
Name?
Tell the nice lady your name.
Danielle.
Danielle what?
Danielle Lloyd.
Putting your details in now.
Danielle's going to have her tonsils removed.
I've got her down for a double hip replacement.
Oh, no, well, there must be some kind of mistake.
Computer says no.
Smart cities, let's find out all about them.
Focus on the issues that affect you with Jess Strutt on ABC Radio Perth and on the ABC Listen app.
Canada's Bianca Wiley has had a front row seat in watching what happens when a tech giant and government attempt to build a community together. Frank Pasquale is also in Perth. He is the author of The Black Box Society, The Secret Algorithms Behind Money and Information. He's a professor of law at the University of Maryland. And Perth's very own Julia Powles is an associate professor of law and technology at the University of Western Australia. Bianca, let's start with, when we talk about smart cities, what does that mean to you?
Cities that use data and technology to deliver public services. It also means industry. And I think that's the critical piece to focus on, is that smart cities have been sort of sold as this product and service that cities and governments should be investing in. And I think in 2019, we really need to think about how functional and how good are these smart cities? Are they worth all of the excitement and all of the potential problems?
You use a terminology there, sold to us. And here's a quote from the City of Perth's statement on the rollout of smart technology here. This data will provide valuable insights and assist decision makers for city planners, businesses and residents in this area, as well as enhance efficiencies of existing safety and security measures. Do you read anything between the lines when I say phrases like that?
Yeah, I mean, I read that we're forgetting history. Data is not a new thing, and I don't think people realize how much governments have already been using data for a long time.
Give us some examples.
Well, I mean, in Canada, Statistics Canada is 100 years old. And so governments have always had data and have always used it for planning purposes. And so I think as we think about using more of it, why? What's the marginal value of having more of it and having more of it in ways, you know, being collected in ways that people don't understand as well? And so between the lines, I would say this is being sort of expressed or shared or sold as it's good. It's the future. It's here. It's exciting. You know, you should get on this train.
And if you don't, you're a bit of a dinosaur.
Right. And that's the political pressure that I think a lot of people face with this. So I think we do need to interrogate more what does this term really mean? What is it doing differently than what's happened in the past? And is this something that's good for us, or is this really just a bit of a scam?
All right, Bianca. So you talked about how the information's being collected. What's happening when I'm walking around a so-called smart city with my phone in my pocket?
That's great that you said phone in your pocket, because I think there's a lot of data collection going on already. And that's an important thing to know, is that we're not starting at zero and then laying in all kinds of other stuff. So you've got a lot of personal data being collected. But in cities, there's often, you know, when you use a public service, like transit, for example, there's points of data collection. So sort of a history. If you can imagine yourself walking around the city or leaving a trail, What did you use? What did you do? When were you there?
I'm getting scared already. I'm terrified. That's it. I'm going to be a hermit for the rest of my life.
But that's what's happening. And I think what we're figuring out now is how much of that is already happening without what I would call social license. I think a lot of data collection is already occurring that we're not, you know, aware of. I say we as the general public. And so I think we really need to understand when you see all the cameras and you see all this technology being laid into our cities and our public spaces, is that a decision everybody's making or is that something that a few people have decided is a good idea and the rest of us really haven't had a time to grapple with the consequences?
So there can be a sense of unease around indiscriminate use of this data. How do we address that?
Well, I think the big divide that's come out when you talk about smart cities, and in Canada, it's really about public and private. Because in Canada, we have two federal laws that look after privacy. One of them relates to how government data can be used, and one of them relates to how private sector data can be used. And in this smart city, those lines blur immensely. And so I think that's where we need to understand where is data being used for something that people are on board with. And a lot of the cases, cities are doing that. But when you introduce what a company is doing with data and what that company is doing with data with the government, you're getting into a bit more complexity. And so I think that's really, it's a core theme is what's the public and what's the private and are we losing track of what's what?
And I want to come to you now, Professor Frank Pasquale from the University of Maryland. This difference between the promise of what a smart city is going to do for us and the reality. Talk me through what some of your takeaways are on that.
Sure. And I do think this is a really important difference. And just to make it really concrete, imagine that these cameras are set up outside of a hospital. You know, there's a lot of concern that, you know, our Julia Powles here has done incredible research on health records and, you know, various aspects of is your medical privacy being secured? Well, this is something that you're doing in public, and there might be a record of everyone that walked into the hospital and how they walked into the hospital. And, you know, there can be a positive side to this. For example, there might be a way of learning from how people walk to seeing we might be able to spot signs of illness earlier or develop other data in that respect. But you could also imagine a world where there are this data is resold and it goes into a score that's like a health score for someone. And that may lead you to, say, not get a job or to be marked in a certain way by marketers or to be understood as being a sicker person than the average person. And so I think that what we have to do is to distinguish between the really positive uses and the negative uses and to try to encourage the positive ones while discouraging, say, uses of data that could be stigmatize people or would be totally unexpected by the people that are being watched by these cameras.
So where do we find the line there, Julia Powles? That's the really difficult question, isn't it?
It's a very interesting conversation in WA at the moment, I think particularly in a government context. You were referring to that difference and Bianca spoke to it. How do you ensure that we get the most out of the data assets that we have? And we have a great history in this state of using data in health, data linkage, longitudinal data sets that are used for the public good. But I think
so child research, for example.
Child research, yep. Absolutely. And sort of population health epidemiology. But then there's this sort of quick turn to now smart city initiatives, and it's been pushed through these big federal grants that have come in the last 2 or 3 years. And you see all sorts of providers coming in saying, we're going to build sensor networks and cameras and somehow create more data assets in our city spaces. And it's, I think, Bianca's point about who is delivering those products, who's selling them to us is really crucial because it's vendors to government and they're vendors that offer quick fix solutions to really deep systemic challenges. And I think that the fix is often not really interrogated by those in the public sector or those who've been doing the research or those who understand really the kind of messy complexity of social problems. And that's particularly the case, and I think it's important to be sectoral about this, particularly the case in health. It's very challenging in child protection. It's challenging in, you know, domains of transit and urban life. And we're actually losing information because we're creating these honeypots of data that are provided to vendors, and then they sell back some insights to the city rather than the other way around.
So you're talking about there's some concerns between government, I suppose, hopping into beds, one way of phrasing it, or coming to work with government and some of the issues that can come out with that. Bianca.
Yeah, well, because sometimes it feels funny to have to remind everyone that the market incentive of a private company is not the same as the government.
Funny that,
right? But let's just, I mean, honestly, sometimes when you listen to these smart city conversations, and this is what happened in Toronto, is you listen to vendors, and if you would close your eyes, you would think they were elected officials. You know, I'm here to improve your quality of life. Okay, but that's not what your shareholders are here for. So there's this sort of rhetoric that is confusing there. And I think with the government piece of it, what we have, at least in Canada, is a problem that started in the 1980s and 1990s, where sort of all of the capacity and the technical capacity for governments to deliver this stuff was reduced, and it was outsourced. And so now we've got this problem where you have governments who aren't even, never mind building this stuff for, you know, for public value, they don't even know how to do the purchasing properly. I mean, if I come and sell you something and you don't know what's in half of it, and someone's telling you, no, this is the future, this is great, you know, you're sort of vulnerable.
We get a lot of that in Western Australia, even with simple things like computer systems. I'm a former political reporter, so we've covered a lot of scandals through that. So
right.
I think that's it at the core, isn't it, where they don't even understand the computer systems. And what you're talking about is another layer of technology that's completely beyond the realm of many politicians and bureaucrats.
Absolutely. And that complexity creates maintenance cost. And I think a lot of the smart city stuff has talked about surveillance and privacy, super important, but equally important and a sort of a whole other topic is what's the value? And are we maintaining systems for the private sector now out of public sector funds when they're scarce enough as it is?
And just to build on the idea of data being misused or used for unexpected purposes, there was a big push in the U.S. in the mid-2000s to gather a lot of people's prescription drug data. And the idea behind that database was, imagine that you're far from home and you have a heart attack or a stroke and you're taken to the emergency room. With this database, we could immediately know what drugs you're on. Well, it turned out that did not have much of a commercial impact. Not many hospitals wanted to subscribe to that. But how the database was used was by insurers who wanted to know which drugs people were on so they could deny them health insurance. And I know that's not a big issue here because you have a more rational health system here, but I still think there is many ways. It's a great cautionary tale because it's a deep problem that, you know, if you are not, once the data is collected, it's there. And despite however promising or however public-spirited the initial rationale may be, that can always change if it's not embedded in law and required.
This person says, if I have the Wi-Fi on my phone switched off, can my data be accessed? Frank's going to give this one a crack.
I'll give it a crack. I mean, this is one of those, I think that I have a direct answer and then I think a bigger picture.
We like direct because when a politician's in here, they're never direct. So you go the direct first.
A direct answer would be if there's cameras on you, then, I mean, it's going to have your face, right? And I think your face, given that there are all these facial recognition databases out there, your face is probably in one of those facial recognition databases. And so that's the big difference that we've entered into now. It's not a world where we can just consent or not consent. Once your face becomes a unique identifier, but my problem is I don't know to what access the municipality or Perth has access to those sort of facial recognition databases, but I would be very worried about it because I think that there are just so many of them out there that your face becomes an identifier. And then it can be connected, for example, to the way you walk, your gait recognition, all sorts of other things about you it could be connected to.
Oh, that's scary.
Yeah, and I'm hesitant to answer about, you know, turning things on and off with phones only because the depth of the complexity that the people who've made cellular phones and all of the related devices and all of the related software, even when you think you're turning things off, you'd be surprised what's still running. And so I just think what rather than give you a direct answer there, where I am going to give you one is that the very reason we have public institutions is so that you don't have to be thinking at every minute of the day, did I do this? Do I turn this on? Do I turn this off? Do I consent? Do I not? That's the point of the public institution, right? You're not supposed to let people harm themselves. You don't make it so you can harm yourself as a consumer choice. And so I think we need to, I'm so happy that people want to take the ownership over addressing these problems. But I think that's where we see the failure of the state and the failure of the institution of public institutions. And so that's why we need to get into better sort of spaces so that you can walk around safely and not have to think about that all the time. And I like to bring it back to the days of, you know, civil engineering and standards. We're standing in this room. We're not worrying about the ceiling falling on our head because it was built to standard. Right? And so we should have the same kind of digital infrastructure where you don't have to check. It's not like we all stood outside and looked at the buildings. Oh, who made this? I don't know. Should we go in? I don't know. What's their thing? We don't want to have to think like that in our public spaces, in our lives.
I won't touch on what's been happening interstate with some of those those high rises, though. But yes, as a general rule, I think you're right there.
Bianca. I'm going to grab Canada there.
Of course, we could always just get rid of our phones. That would be my direct answer. But of course, we can't really do that. But as much as I'd like to most of the time, Darren on the text line says, as much as I don't like smart technology, I can live with smart cities. But what I can't stand is smart homes. Darren, I'm with you. That stuff terrifies me, but maybe I'm alone. Now, what settings do we need then to get it right in order for us as citizens to feel comfortable living in a smart city? Frank?
I think the first thing, to go into another one of the folks on the text line mentioned security, and is this information secured? And we're seeing a real rash in the U.S. of cities getting ransomware, all of their data being held hostage by hackers. And so the first thing I think is necessary is to disseminate certain standards to stop that possibility and to really make sure that the cities are securing this information. But that's just a first step.
Yeah, so I wanted to just give a few examples of smart city initiatives in Perth.
Please do. That would really give us some context.
Yeah. So there have been, I think, between 12 and 15 released in the last 18 months. And they range across environmental projects, sort of sensor networks that are looking at things like air quality and irrigation and other measures. There are smart parks, which are really an interesting concept, because the idea is somehow that we'll have more engagement in follow this. I don't quite follow the logic, but we'll have more engagement from our children in park environments through something mediated by app, which is, you know, how it's kind of a gamified park experience. I find that very problematic. You know, a third of people online are under 18, and I think getting the settings right for that group of people will make a huge difference for all of us. And one of them would probably be when you're 4 years old and you're in a park, you don't really want that tracked and collected.
Absolutely.
But there are several smart parks. There's also, I think the most controversial one which you raised is this East Perth trial. And it's really problematic because WA, as you've been covering in Focus, is the only state without a proper privacy regime. And in the absence of a privacy regime, a system that is rolled out as a trial in a part of it's under city government, and it's supposed to be doing a suite of things, you know, transit management, security management, community, a sort of community-enabled security system, which is problematic, sort of bringing our neighbours into the surveillance of one another. I just think it's operating in this completely unmoored way. It's detecting, and based on facial recognition databases that we don't know what's populating them, where are those images coming from. And as Frank says, I mean, the one thing that you cannot get away from is your face or your gait, and the implications of containing that within a system that has this diffuse range of purposes, I think is really problematic, and it's particularly problematic in WA.
This person says, hi, about the smart cities and data collection, I ask why. What do they want my data for? What are they doing with it? What about my photo or my driver's license? Will they know where I am? And why do they need to know? I got into trouble in 1985 and I got a year's probation and 50 hours community service. Will this information be made available? And if so, why? There are too many questions and they're not being answered except to be told our data is safe and we're doing nothing wrong. So why worry? I mean, that is that when I was reading through the notes for today, I was like, you know, that old chestnut of like, you know, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, why would you be worried? And I do tend to sometimes in my simplistic mind go back there. Why is that not an okay approach to take, Bianca?
Well, for a couple of reasons. I think one of them, some people have said lately, and I think it's a great way to put it, that privacy is a time delay problem. So what you think you're okay with people knowing about you today, maybe in 8 years, you won't be so glad that that's recorded and held.
And it's like pictures, right? When you go to a party and, you know, in the moment in your 20 years and your 20s and you're drunk and you do whatever, you get dressed up, and then 15 years later, you're like, damn, I really don't wish them to be on Facebook anymore.
Right. So there's that. But I think the bigger one is that, and if you look at a city, it's a good example of it. Transportation planners have been using a lot of data for a long time. They know where people are or not based on some of the cards that you can use to tap and go on a subway system or something like that. So they're using it in the public interest, in the public good. You know, you've got the hospital using it. You've got the library using it. You've got all these different places using data. What you don't have is somebody currently looking at that ecosystem as a whole, which is it's an entirely different problem, because where I'm from, there's a basic rule of law that is built on the fact that we don't know where everybody is all the time. We don't know that. We're not supposed to know that. we're very close to knowing that. That is a fundamental problem of justice, right? And so if you look at these things piecemeal and say, oh, the transit thing, oh, the luck, okay, except you have to zoom out and understand that if you complete that sort of surveillance infrastructure, we have fundamental things that we're not wrangling right now. And it's not going to be the transportation planner's problem. It's not going to be the librarian's problem. And it shouldn't be your problem either. So I think there's a bigger issue here. That's the thing that we need to be talking about more as a group, because it's trade-offs discussions, right? Like, these are trade-offs discussions. If your train's a little quicker, your bus is on time, or there's, you know, a little bit of an improvement, is it worth all of the other consequences that might come with all of that data being held?
You were Jess Strutt on the Focus program, ABC Radio Perth. Bianca, you came to this almost by accident as an advocate in this area, which starts with the story of a place called Quayside. Can you tell me about that?
I would love to. Before, though, I'm way too excited to hear what Julia was going to say about the rule of law, if I may.
Okay.
I can't pay attention until the answer goes.
Oh, no, I just, there. I love this point that we've got this fundamental change that's happening. We're sleepwalking straight into it. So we were used to having still a degree of privacy in public. And I think what these technologies are creating is a situation where that's gone and it will never come back.
When you say we, are you saying we as citizens, or is the government also a bit sleepwalking as well?
Both, yeah, absolutely. And I think that our politicians expect a degree of it the same as any of us. And I think that's where your listener who said about the smart home, you know, it's the same assault on private space. But I think there's a second element of the smart city, which is a profound challenge to the rule of law. And that's, we centre you and everything about you, the listener who had the incident in 1985, as what is most crucial to at the heart of our justice system. And the dynamics of data collection and use are that the one thing that doesn't actually matter is you. What matters is everyone who is like you. And so when we lose that ability to, we both lose our individuality in place and our ability to be private, and then the decisions that get made about you and the sort of life chances that you're afforded are based on a kind of collection of information of people who maybe you are nothing like, but there are elements of your patterns and predictive behaviours that that direct you to certain outcomes. And I don't think we have dealt with that at all as we're rolling these systems out into all sorts of domains of public life.
Well, I just wanted to just build on Julia's points in terms of, but yes, to think about concrete examples of, say, pattern of life analysis. You know, one of the problems that I think is really key here that we've been seeing in some U.S. data brokers is people are put on lists that say, this is a diabetic, this is someone who has cancer, this is, say, a cancer-concerned individual, et cetera. And people are just beginning to find out that they're on these lists. And some of them don't have diabetes. They don't have cancer. I mean, there's two levels of problems here, one being that the lists are inaccurate, the second being that people just have no idea that they're even on these lists and they have no chance to contest them. And so that, I think the data gathering is important. And if I could just use one analogy to the problem that we face here, you know, sure, you may think, hey, it saw that I was running at 3 p.m. yesterday and I don't care. And it saw something out of me. I don't care. People may not care much about it, but the real stakes here are the aggregation of a huge digital dossier on you, not just what's in these cameras, but all across the web. And I think there's something similar here in thinking about the threat from this as the threat from pollution. I mean, 50 years ago, when we first heard about the problem of pollution, you know, yes, some people might say, if a car goes by, it's not like that car and its exhaust is going to cause me to get cancer. So, you know, where's the causation? But we understood as a society that it raised the risk of cancer for everybody. It was a diffuse risk. Maybe only 50 people out of a million would get cancer because of the auto exhaust, but we still did something about it. I think there's something very similar here to going on with data. It's not as if, you know, any particular camera is going to ruin your life, but the aggregation of so much information into these dossiers really demands a general response, just as we had with environmental law, and we need it with privacy law too.
Back to Quayside.
Yeah, and these are two great points to sort of riff on with Quayside. Maybe I'll start with some of these collective uses that have been proposed, but I'll take you back to 2017, where I sat in a room and there were two CEOs. One of them was Sidewalk Labs. One of them was Sidewalk Labs, and the other one was the company that is working on the smart neighborhood in Toronto. And the other one was the CEO of a group called Waterfront Toronto, which is a tripartite government agency that looks after real estate in the waterfront. Long story short, there was a meeting and you had these two CEOs talking about their desire to build the neighborhood of the future, build it from the internet up. And it was sort of presented as, we're here, we're going to spend $50 million US dollars and make a plan for this neighborhood. We'll do it with you, the community.
We'll take you along with us.
We'll take you along with us. Yeah, yeah. Very much presented as normative good. All levels of government were at the announcement, everybody excited. And I think there's two major things I'd like to sort of, you know, point out about this. The first one is that when Sidewalk Labs launched this project in 2017, they already had the former Privacy Commissioner of Ontario as a consultant to their work. And I want to repeat this many times, and it sort of doubles up on the points, both from Jillian and Frank. Industry wants us to talk about privacy. If we keep talking about privacy, we will not talk about privatization. And privatization is a major threat here. We are talking about privatizing public assets and public infrastructure through digitization, right? And so I think it's very critical to think if Sidewalk Labs is at the forefront of this, they brought forward ideas around artificial intelligence in energy use in a building, artificial intelligence about garbage and recycling, collective usage of information for transportation systems. You know, these types of examples where they're saying, we're not interested in your personal privacy. We just want to make things run differently and smoother. And if you think about that, that is the role of the government. The complexity inherent to systems where we live, where these ecosystems are full of trade-offs, cities have been doing this for a very long time. And to think that private industry should be the one who's making decisions about trade-offs with public assets is a very troubling assumption. And that assumption was exerted in full force by the three levels of Canadian government. So I think that's really important to hang on to. The second piece, which we haven't talked about today, but is really important, I'm so curious what it's like in Perth, is the economic development narrative. And so around the world right now, countries want to be innovation nations. Cities want to be understood as innovation places, the places where they work with data, artificial intelligence, chips, 5G is coming around the corner. And so there's sort of this bet being made in the economy. And that bet is reliant on mass data collection. So we have this fundamental issue right now, to my mind, which is if we should be minimizing this thing, but we're also suggesting it's the future of our economy, what are we doing here? Because in Canada, the federal level politicians looked at the Quayside project, not because of the improvements to the city life. It's because there was going to be a Google office put on the waterfront. Totally different sale, totally different pitch, totally different impact. And it's because, you know, politicians in Toronto were excited about having a Google office. Completely has nothing to do with the function of the city. And so I just think we also really need to hold on to that economic development narrative, because in Perth or maybe other cities, what they start to do is they say, we're going to have all this data collection. You know what that's going to feed? Our local entrepreneurs.
Right. Yep.
And so we need that.
So again, it's the big sell job.
Let's do it. Let's get this data flowing, because from that data will come more jobs and more innovation, more economic development. And that's a very siren call right now.
So we should be wary of the benefits that we're being sold. We could be getting sold a pup in a sense.
Yes. And I think there's also an aspiration, just to build on Bianca's point about, there's this aspiration among some of these companies to actually take over a law-giving role. So I saw a proposal for a smart city where they said, all right, we have noise ordinances. You know, how late can you be noisy? And there are certain laws about that. But they said, as with a smart city, we can be smarter with this. And what we can do is we can find out at what level of decibels of sound is there a complaint about someone? And when do those complaints happen? And then we're going to translate those complaints into a broader sense of when we will go after someone or warn them about their noise and when not. Now, on the one hand, you might say, well, that's good data that the government should consider. But some of the smart city visions would just cut out the government altogether and say, this private corporation now is the noise czar. And I think that's a real problem when you think about that possibility of the corporation sort of running, say, Uber running transport, Airbnb running housing, and then having some noise czar out there on top of everything else.
Yeah, it's Big Brother for sure, isn't it?
Yeah, and a quick jump on that. The problem, we've set ourselves up for this so badly because cities are not completely defensible right now. They're not doing all of their things perfectly. Of course they're not. And so the problem is you have the population in a city split into two camps. You have the people who can afford and the privilege of affording and saying, oh, there's this private thing. Fantastic. I'm going to use that. And then you have a whole bunch of other people who live in the city who experience a smart city completely differently, and they would be the first ones whose service delivery would go down because they don't have money in the same way that Group A may have. And so you really, you know, smart cities work along demographic lines and they really work along income lines. So what happens in a smart city, say that you've got all these new options and new technology and wow, what a great interface for my automatic garbage thing. And yeah, I'm excited about this program. And oh yeah, they have my data. You know what? If I got a problem, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to hire a lawyer. Some people can afford to do that. Some people cannot afford to do that. And you think about who's going to, you know, experience the city and how. What is fundamentally, you know, happening with this is cities are getting these libertarian, which is the Silicon Valley sort of style, set of solutions, which is to say, and this goes back to Julia's point about the collective. If it's good for you and you like it, you say, yeah, I like it. So I want to have it. So thanks for bringing it to me. City's not doing a great job on this. So I'm going to buy into this thing. Right. And so now you have people who are thinking much more about themselves than about their collective. And here we are destroying the social fabric of what it means to be in a city with your neighbors and to think about each other. And that's how, you know, that's how you're supposed to make choices in, honestly, in liberal democracy. It's about you have to make choices for the group. Right. It's like how insurance works. You all agree, hey, a few of us here are going to get sick. So we're all going to pay in and we're going to deal with it. That's not the thinking behind a lot of the smart city products and services.
So let's look at the West Australian context then. How do we stack up? We're obviously really different, a really different setting. So what are some of the things that we as citizens, you talked about us almost going into this sort of blind, being blindly led in a sense. What are some of the things that we as citizens can do to ensure that we don't end up with these sorts of problems that have been raised today, Julia Powles?
Yeah, well, it's so interesting that Bianca talks about the economic development aspect of this. The smart city facial recognition trial in East Perth is actually being led by the Acting Director of Economic Development and Innovation for the City of Perth. And it's very interesting that that same person is talking about issues like safety and security. There was just a few days ago a report on what had happened. You know, we were speaking before the show about the lack of evidence. While we have very good evidence about the risks of surveillance and the way in which people has a chilling effect and all sorts of things, somehow the promises never have to be validated. And the promise and benefits of the Smart City Project so far seem to be very much about efficiency and cost savings, and this terminology of shared value. And it's very interesting when you read the report that shared value is very much between the City of Perth and vendors. And so I think where citizens have an opportunity is to say this isn't about a long-term relationship between private entities and the city. It's about the relationship between citizens and each other. And if our best version of the future is just lading our streets with sensors and cameras, I think that's a pretty limited vision of what innovation could achieve.
And I suppose part of the issue here is that we keep talking about the apathy of citizens, the growing apathy of citizens. So there's this thing that all of this stuff's happening for our benefit, but as you're saying, it may not be for our benefit as a citizen. So it's time for us to almost become more aware of this and start questioning more.
And this is a complexity that as an academic I find quite challenging. So Bianca's point about the way in which we're lured, the only ready-to-hand tool we have is privacy. And I think that what we're saying here is actually a lot of this stuff is a scam and then some of it's really wrong. And we defer to the prism of, well, but I don't, you know, privacy is the only word we have for that. And actually, we've got a set of problems here. We've got privatization, we've got platformization. The whole city now city government's just an app on top of a platform designed by outside players. And we have domination. We have major players moving to cities. In Australia, Microsoft is moving in a strong way into various cities. Uber is very prominent in Australia. I think it's a leading country where they're trying to integrate urban transit in the image of Uber. And I think that we need to be able to elbow space for challenging what are actually unsubstantiated promises and sort of mass privatization bids, while also preserving that, yeah, we don't want to abandon what we've always had, which is the ability to maintain a degree of discreteness and to maintain relationships and to decide when and what we share. So I think we need to balance all those things. And I guess the opportunity, I mean, I would love for this particular, you know, little wedged window of opportunity in the next 2 weeks when Perth citizens can have a say on the privacy and information sharing bill in the state government. If you don't think that that document speaks to these issues, then say we have a once-off opportunity to actually get the settings right and to advocate for the kind of urban environment that we want. We have an amazing city here, and why would we create it in the same image as kind of the designs of global companies and vendors that want to sell facial recognition technology the world over without any sort of adaptation to the particular place that we're in?
Is it alluring to get into bed with the companies because not only they've got the technology, but do they, I mean, in a sense, is it expensive to deliver this stuff, what the government's talking about, the privacy legislation and the rollout out of some of this stuff? Is it expensive? Is it better off doing it through in collaboration with the private sector?
I think what's considered expensive is if you don't innovate. Okay. And so if you don't accept the promises. Mm. But I'd like to run that experiment. I mean, really, would Perth really miss out if we didn't engage an Israeli facial recognition company to use its cameras on our city streets? I don't know. I think we've got quite a lot to say for ourselves.
You wanted to respond, Frank, to some of the points that Julia was just making.
Yeah, and I think that the issue of the costs and, you know, can government deliver it? Two responses. One is I'm really worried about a world where at some point we get governments that are not only contracting things out to privatize, but are incompetent to understand what type of choices they're making. Mm-hmm. We now have some Defense Department contractors in the U.S. who are contracting out to contractors the choice of contractors, right? So this is
the ultimate, isn't it? It's mm-hmm. the ultimate. It's abdicating responsibility, basically, and it's a bit like that show that we've got here. What's it called? It's gone from my mind now. Utopia. There it is. Oh, Utopia.
I've seen it's a great show.
It's a fantastic show.
And the other side of it is, I think this could be a Faustian bargain. All right, so Miami is about to vote on this law that will essentially have a private company set up all of these streetlights that have cameras on them. The company says, we'll do it for free. We just want the data on everybody. And my question is, what are they going to use that data for? I mean, it's very interesting. It's a very costly project. But on the other hand, you know, we didn't allow...
Well, so why are we paying taxes? We're paying taxes for the lights anyway, so it's double dipping, really, isn't it?
It does sound a lot like double dipping, and I think it could be a real Faustian bargain if we don't know how that data is being used.
Yeah, and I think in cities, these conversations about value, we're struggling to apply things that we already know we need to do, whether it's about reducing usage of automobiles, whether it's about doing, you know, using different construction materials, that we've got the climate crisis. We have a lot of solutions to issues where we just don't have the political will to apply those solutions, and we need to find the confidence to push on those types of solutions in our cities, because the sort of marginal value of trying to solve things with all this complexity and data and the maintenance costs and all the rest of it, it's like we're getting distracted at the edge of a problem instead of focusing on the core and core solutions. And I think what I know I struggle with in Canada, we are going through reconciliation, you know, with Indigenous peoples, and they are knowledge keepers. They've looked after lands for a long time. How do we value the knowledge that it's not this data, quantified future, robots, da-da-da-da, these things that people have known forever, you know, and we're just not used to respecting and applying that kind of knowledge. And so I think we have to realize, we have to look at a bigger time scale, go back to post-enlightenment. Like, data is becoming like religion. It's getting dangerous that somehow every solution is now, it's getting religious, right? And that became a problem. And I think we need to look at that time scale and say, okay, hold on. We know what we should be doing. Let's go the simple path. And I think it's when you talk about Perth and what we need to do right now, technologists need to come out and start to say a lot of this is nonsense.
Because we assume that technologists are all on board.
Yeah, absolutely not.
So it's refreshing to hear that that's not the case.
And we need to go help the politicians hold space to say, that's a nonsense, that's a nonsense, that's a nonsense. We're not doing it. I'm very pro-innovation. I'm very pro-technology. And so I know what bad technology is, so I'm not investing in that. Thank you very much. We need to help that confidence get developed in the public service and in the government. And I think exactly, you know, what Julia was saying about elbows up right now. Like, we need to slow it down, because all we're doing is mitigating this rush of sort of unvalidated, completely unaccountable technology. Smart cities, it's almost been a decade. Where is all the benefit? If this is how we're going to get to a clean new future and all of these other things, like, where is it? There are cases. I think some great ones, like industrial Internet of Things is an example, where you think about having sensors on pipes so you catch water leaks. Go for it. I'm all here for it. That warehouse may be in a city. If that's what you mean by smart city, let's do it. But some of this other complexity is just really unnecessary, and it's not addressing what is at the core. And we know what we should be doing in our cities, and we need to respect the people who've worked in the industries that support public, you know, public assets, public infrastructure, engineers, all of this stuff. We know what we should be doing. Let's focus on doing that, and let's not get distracted by a lot of the scams that are going on right now. So critical for technologists to get in there and put the elbows up. We've all got our elbows up here in the studio, right, guys?
Have we got enough local technologists? They have. They actually have, and it's terrifying. It's like a scrum is coming towards me. Have we got enough technologists to be able to speak out in this space? Because, you know, in Perth, we are always talking about the innovation. Yeah. We're leading in entrepreneurship and, yeah. you know, this is stuff that's well beyond my realms.
Right, but it's not about, you know, this is the thing, math and political science, if you look at these things together, you can use computer science in non-commercial ways. Like, this is what is so frustrating for technologists who know how to build things. We can build them for communities. We can build community infrastructures. We can build networks. We can build products. We need to be able to build those things without there only being profit models for them, just like lots of other infrastructure. Like, it's not profitable. Look at the infrastructure in cities. This is what should be scary about privatization. It is not profitable to run infrastructures that everybody has access to. So we need to accept that. We need to stop thinking somehow there's going to be some magical business that's going to create a way that infrastructure is available to all. So I think there are plenty of technologists who have that capacity. We need to fund them. We need to invest. We need to think about building our own sort of civic infrastructures, much like we did the highways and all the rest of it, which wasn't a great choice. But on that scale of building technology infrastructures, absolutely could do it, but it's a political will problem. This is a political investment problem. This is not people doing it on the side of their desk.
Final word on a local perspective then, Julia?
Oh, look, I have some tremendous colleagues in the university sector. You've had some on here, Vanessa Teague, David Glantz, Rachel Cuddle, Oliver, who work on using technology in the public interest. And I think that the reality is that to save innovation and the technological promise, I do think we need a little bit of friction. We need our elbows up. We need to get it right, because actually, otherwise, we're going to stop it. So I think getting it right, and if that takes a little bit more time, like, we haven't solved these problems yet. There isn't the proof. Bianca's absolutely right. We've had the same promises for a decade. No genuine proof. So let's go small and get it right.
Got to wrap it up. My big thanks to Julia Powles, finishing up that conversation, Associate Professor of Law and Technology at the University of Western Australia, Bianca Wiley, the co-founder of Tech Reset Canada, and Professor Frank Pasquale. Elbows up, everyone. Elbows up. Whew, scary.